Ken, stay with us if you would. We're going to talk now to Tom Burke. Tom is an Irish filmmaker, and he's made a movie called Losing Alaska. We'll let you listen to a clip of it, and then Tom will tell us all about this movie.
Grandfather, he used to say, this new top will become one big island. It's already an island. We've got river around us, and when the high wind comes in, it's like this one big island surrounded by the water. Water.
I think people who are thinking about staying here forget that it floods here in the fall. People who stay need to be prepared to be devastated by some kind of flood.
Our elders used to warn us about this kind of weather before. I don't know how they knew, but they used to say this land will be gone after they pass down to the next life. And this has been the worst erosion ever. Eating land like it was candy.
In 2003, we lost 150 feet of land from water washing away land. The nearest home to the water is about 100 yards. We are going to have a disaster if we don't move. We need to act as soon as possible before the water gets to us, or it will eat us like Cookie Monster eating cookies.
The land just falls down and it cannot pick itself up.
I think we're a part of America that the rest of America forgot.
How many miles are?
Now, Newtok is a small village of 375 people in Alaska. The plight of its residents brings into sharp focus the issue of climate change and the devastating impact it's having. In this instance, on this impoverished native Alaskan Yupik community, because their houses are slowly but surely sliding into the Ninglick River as the land upon which they were built is worn away by coastal storms and thawing permafrost. As I said, Tom Burke is the Irish filmmaker who's made this movie titled Losing Alaska. Tell me more, Tom.
Well, you've said a lot of it there. I've been visiting the village since 2015, attracted by this story of primarily the story of climate change, coastal erosion, the idea that you could see in front of you with the camera land falling into the sea, the literal effects of climate change, unambiguous effects of climate change. That was the first thing that drew me in. The second thing that drew me in was this idea that they were going to pioneer a new village, which I always think is a very American concept, this idea that we can kind of pick everything up and move up the road. And then the third element was this tribal dispute, this rift in a small village of less than 400 people. You had this very fundamental rift between these two factions, and that was preventing them from moving forward. And I thought all those three things together had the makings of a good story, combined with some visually, like a place that looks like no other.
Well, describe it for us.
You've got, Newtok is on what they call the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, so it's between these two enormous rivers, the Yukon and the Kusko. It's a part of Alaska that nobody really cares about, because if they were slightly further south, there would be the commercial fishing of Bristol Bay. If they were slightly further north and further north again, there would be oil, there would be mineral deposits. Where they are, there's nothing. There's nothing that the Western world is really interested in. So they are incredibly isolated. It's 70 miles to Chivak, it's 40 miles to Tuksuk, it's 90 miles back to Bethel. So if you can imagine flat tundra and kind of nothingness in every direction. As a filmmaker, as a visual storyteller, it was an incredible place to be able to work.
Why you? I mean, you said you've been going there since 2015. Why? What brought you up there in the first place, if it's so remote and isolated?
I'm always interested in how communities work. Why do people choose to gather up together and live together, and then why do they stay together? What are the dynamics that make that work? So I had made a film in Dublin years ago about the Liberties, which was very much along those lines, kind of what makes a community coherent and how does it function. I thought I could bring those interests to Alaska and kind of examine some of the same issues, but in the context of this threat.
Yeah, but you just picked yourself up from where? Where are you from originally?
Malahide.
Malahide. You pick yourself up. So Richard lives out there too. But you pick yourself up from Malahide and you deposit yourself here and you talk.
That's, to be honest though, if you're interested in this line of work, if you're going to make documentaries,
how did you hear about them is what I'm wondering, you know. Give me the background to the story.
I read about them in The Guardian in 2013, 2014. Okay. So that's where I kind of got these stories, the three elements that I talked about. And indeed, the reporter for The Guardian did an excellent series of articles. Right. But the series of articles can only tell you so much. Your listeners would have just heard Raman and Grant and Bosco. There's a very particular way that the UPIC speak. There's a particular rhythm to it that can't really come across in a newspaper article. That flat tundra, that incredible landscape, that can't really come across in a newspaper article. And I think what a feature documentary can bring to it is this kind of longitudinal aspect, where I have the luxury, thanks to the way Screen Ireland operates, I'm able to go over a period of 3 years and really follow things in a calm way and not to a particular deadline. Which the newspaper also would have. So that's some of the reasons why.
How do they live there? What's their industries?
There's no industry.
So what is it?
It's subsistence.
Do they have money? Excuse my ignorance now.
They do. No, it's a fair question. And I've been asked that question before. The economic backbone of the village is a subsistence lifestyle. So in any given month, they are out fishing or hunting for the particular animal.
Yeah,
that's available in that season. So there would be salmon fishing in the summer, preceded by herring fishing. After that, there would be halibut. After that, there would be moose. After that, there would be muskox. Geese are plentiful all year round. They shoot tamarins. So whatever the month is, they will be trying to catch something different and kind of fill up the freezers. Mm. Beyond that, there are some government jobs within the village. There are some native corporations. There's a shop, there's a school. There's a small amount of employment. But really, that subsistence lifestyle is the backbone of the economy.
But their houses are falling away into the river.
The land...
I got this right now. I mean, it must be some big river if your house is falling into the river. You know,
the river is quite big. The land has been falling away year by year since the late 90s. And slightly before. So they identified this as a problem around 1996, and they said, if this pattern continues, we think we're going to have a problem in the, around about now actually, in the early part of this century. And so the planning began then. When I first went in 2015, there was maybe somewhere around 100 metres to go, just under 100 metres from Nathan Tom's house all the way to the edge. And I went in March, and when everything was totally frozen and nothing was moving, and I was looking at it skeptically, going, you know, really, is it really going to become a problem very soon? Two trips later, and about 40 of those meters were gone already. And on my last trip, Nathan Tom's house was 10 feet from the edge. Now, his house has since been demolished before it could fall into the river. But that... Again, it is not ambiguous at this point. The coastline is retreating. In my 3 or 4 years looking at the village, that 100 metres is gone. And even more than that now, the site that Nathan's house occupied now doesn't exist anymore.
And what's the cause?
They will tell you that the cause is a general warming of the temperatures such that the permafrost... which is supposed to be, you're supposed to get about one or two feet down and you hit permafrost. And that's always, as the name suggests, that's always frozen. The top layer, which is kind of this boggy, turfy layer, that freezes and unfreezes every season. And that's a process that happens. What has been happening is the unfreezing, the melting, has been going down further, down through the ground. And then when the freeze is coming later, and it's shorter. So they are used to winters that really get going in late October. Mm-hmm. And for the last few years, there's been no snow on the ground on Christmas Day. So they're seeing those kind of changes. So the permafrost that used to be able to resist the tide and the storms because it was frozen solid, is now not able to resist those storms. And when the storm comes in, again, it's like this boggy material. You see it in the film. It gets undercut and undercut and it falls
down. And it's
down.
Just eroded. So it's global warming. Climate change.
Climate change, yeah.
Ken, you've been in this part of the world, I'm sure, in Alaska.
Yeah, I have. And it's very similar to similar situation. You'll see just across, as we were speaking about the other side, in terms of the tundra I know best is in a place called the Kola Peninsula in Russia, which reminded me so much of Tom's film last night. And his description is perfect in the sense that in a big river system, you have natural erosion and deposition. So you have land being eroded by the currents. You have land then being built up then by banks of gravel and so on. But I think it was Jackie on the film last night explained really well what the problem was. And fundamentally, there's a big aspect to this which the film captures, which is not just the climate change, but why are the people here? If they're hunter-gatherers, if they're nomadic people, why are they in this very unusual spot?
Why don't they move?
Absolutely. And Jackie explained that really well in terms of the political, the socio-political reason why these people were actually encouraged to take up this particular location. And I won't go into it in detail, but she was basically saying that
it's not
when
quite
they
quite a spoiler alert. Can I just say for the benefit of the listener, you didn't miss it. Ken had a preview, as did Richard, of the movie, so it hasn't been broadcast yet. Come on, tell us, Ken.
So really what I was going to say was that the reason the people have been there is because there was a decision made that the town should be built in that particular location. Whereas in reality, the town really should have been built on slightly higher ground. So they were a hostage to fortune, as I understood it.
A decision made by the federal government rather than by the tribes themselves.
The tribes, So they were a hostage to fortune to some extent. But this loss of the permafrost and this disappearance of the tundra, I did some work on the Kola a few years ago where our job was to fly into the tundra and actually look at the effects that this was having in terms of the upper parts of these salmon rivers. And certainly with the Sami people in that location, they were very concerned over this because it looked very similar. This was way inland now. This wasn't the sea, but there were massive areas of still water. There were lakes, there were ponds, all sorts of things. This is 1 million acres, the area I was looking at. So they were very concerned over the effects that the waves in the lakes were having on the permafrost that was now only semi-permanent, and where they were having the same issues in terms of very late winters, very severe shorter winters in what would have been their early spring, but much later than they would have seen. And this was impacting on their system of life as well. So they were forced into a situation where they were now beginning to over-harvest some of their particular resources because the other resources that would have come with the very harsh winter were not appearing on time. So I could relate so much to the movie. I thought it was fantastic, and it tells this the social side of it as well as the biological and the physical side of the global warming issue.
Tom, looking at your film, I thought of two things. Pyrite in Ireland.
Okay.
And building houses on floodplains. It seems to me that we don't have to go all the way to Alaska to find a very acute parallels. It also came into my head, looking at your excellent documentary, you are in a great tradition. Robert Flaherty was half Irish, his mother was half German, but he is described as the father of documentary. He was the Man of Arran was a famous example, which we might talk about in a minute, but he also made one called Nanook of the North, which I remember seeing on the Film Society circuit back in the 1960s. Yes, it was a black and white film with captions in between, and it described Nanook and his ferocious struggle with nature and adversity, and him making igloos and hunting walruses and all this kind of stuff, do you see? It actually goes back to Singh, I think, because Singh was the original perpetrator of this kind of thing with his Aran Islands and what's her name? Riders to the Sea, you know. And they're all gone now. And there's nothing the sea can do to me anymore. And I'll have no need to be queening when the wind breaks from the south and all this kind of stuff, you know. But actually, I remember Gustin Martin in your city when we were studying that particular place saying, you know, if you look at the statistics for people killed or drowning in the Aran Islands, they were no worse than anywhere else. The odd fisherman drowned, and there were big tragedies like the one in Achill. But this was a total fabrication. And then Flaherty took that up and made a totally ridiculous film, in a way, factually ridiculous film.
No, hang on a second. You started off by liking him to Flaherty. Now you're saying you have a point.
I have a point, and I've loved about your film is that you didn't go down that ancient Irish road of exaggeration and what's the phrase? Sexing it up is the phrase.
No.
You gave a very accurate, it seemed to me, account of it, and you didn't exaggerate at all.
No, and in a way, again, I'm lucky in the way the film was made. I've got space to be subtle. Nobody is looking for a dramatic fifth act. I have a responsibility, because I'm making a documentary, that it should be rooted in fact and it should be honest. And in a way, the fact there isn't a dramatic climax to the film, that's not a spoiler alert. It is an observation of reality, and it's also not necessarily providing any conclusions. It's giving you a window into this community that most Irish people will never ever get the opportunity to go to, and presenting as many characters and circumstances as I could. And the viewer has to do an amount of work to make up their own mind as to what they think is going on.
But what did you set out to do? Did you set out to say global warming, climate change is a problem, these people are losing their homes, or here is a kind of snapshot in time, over 3 years albeit, of a community that live on the edge?
No, I think, again, you have to be very careful not to have too much of a plan. I remember in early days when I used to pitch ideas, and you'd pitch a documentary idea and they'd say, well, what's the ending? And you'd have to say, I don't know yet, because the story hasn't played out yet. Again, because of the way the film was funded, I had the luxury of going, I'm going to investigate this because I think it's interesting, and I don't know what the ending is going to be. So I didn't know if they were going to successfully found a new village. I didn't know if a terrible storm would appear at some point in that 3 years and wipe out several houses. I had permission to be curious and to go and investigate.
Did they found a new town? Did a storm come along and wipe out all the houses?
I encourage people to go and see the film and find out.
But we'll say where you can do that shortly.
What I would say is, and the film has been doing festivals around Europe, and I got asked that question in terms of, you know, what is the film trying to do? I guess the film is trying to be a cautionary tale in the broader sense about climate change. If it was only about climate change, it wouldn't be a very interesting film, I don't think. It should be about people facing this slow-moving disaster. And the cautionary tale is, here is a village where the effects of climate change, the threat to them, is unambiguous, and yet they have found it very, very hard to marshal the resources to get them to
safety.
Why?
Is it the federal government don't care? The local government doesn't care? Or they, they're a little bit manana themselves. What's the situation?
There are layers. There are definitely layers. As I said earlier, they're not in a part of Alaska that anybody particularly cares about. Mm. They are not resource rich. Mm. They're in a native Alaskan village. They're a very small constituency. They don't have a lot of political power. There is an amount of inherent racism in the whole thing. As we were talking about, the whole reason the village was there in the first place is that the federal government said, it was actually three separate tribes. They said, you three tribes will settle here, your children will attend that school, and if they do not, we will take your children and send them to our boarding school. So it's a kind of a shameful chapter in Alaska and the United States history. So there are several factors as to why it has taken them this long. And again, the viewer can kind of transplant that then to, well, if some other community was under threat, what would be the variables? If this was happening in Miami, would it have taken them so long? If it was happening in Hong Kong...
The national emergency declared immediately. But surely they have conversations and they say, your house is about to fall into the sea, we better do something about that.
They do, but again, they're somewhat disempowered from...
Well, we're simplifying it now.
..from doing that. A little bit, yeah. They are American citizens. Mm. They are, you know, they are their own tribe. But if a lot of those houses were put there by the federal government. And so if they were to go and try and jack one up and move it, questions would have to be answered. So in a way, when you take the tribe that was seasonally, what's the word I'm looking for, migratory, a link there got broken in the 50s and 60s when they said you can't go from, there was winter camp, there was summer camp, there was fish camp. You can't do any of that anymore. And you're going to live in this village that the federal government is going to build. A kind of an amount of autonomy, a link with their own mobility was broken there. Mm. And so,
and as Richard said, built it in a floodplain.
Yes, bullying, they used to call that in Ireland, where you moved the stock up the mountain and down the mountain and you moved the entire village, that sort of thing. But I wanted to ask you about another more concrete aspect. You were going in there, a kind of Livingston in Darkest Africa kind of a feel, you know. This anthropologist arriving with a camera was going to study us and all this kind of thing, and he's one of them, these awful people in the American government, the kind of people. Was there a problem that you had? Were you all on your own, or did you have a sound on your own?
No, I was on my own.
You're flying into this village, you're looking for a place to stay, you're fraternizing, there aren't pubs and things, are there? And,
no.
The practicalities of that. How did you ingratiate yourself into this township kind of situation?
I'll try and be brief. That really was the work of the first year, because they are used to a white person coming in, and usually it's not in a very positive context. They might be their teachers, which are mostly positive, social workers, tax collectors, accountants, whatever. They are kind of arms of the federal government. And then sometimes there's journalists, news reporters who come in for a day, do a package and leave. I was different in that my trips would be long. There would be 2 to 3 weeks. And so they were always surprised after 2 or 3 days that I was still there. And then on the second trip and into the third trip, as Grant in particular, Grant Cashtook, the school principal, as he started to read about Ireland and Irish history and understand what Irish meant in the context of everything else. And he realised that we were colonised rather than colonisers. And so conversations with him then started to open doors where he believed that I might be able to see things from their perspective. And so really on that, it wasn't until the third trip that all sorts of doors started to open. And also because on trip one, I said I'd be coming back. And they said, yeah, sure, you know, see you again. And then on trip two, they're like, oh, you came back. Okay. And at the end of that, I said, I'm coming back again. They said, yeah, right. And when I came back the third time, they were like, okay, this guy is, you're serious. You're actually serious about this. And then a lot of the stories started to flow. And frequently, kind of to answer that earlier question, frequently it's about talking to people without the camera. You know, it's about all the time, all the things that you do without the camera. It's cups of tea. It's, helping gut the fish. It's all this very soft stuff that does generate genuine intimacy, such that when it's time to pick up the camera, they're no longer talking to unknown white cameramen. They call they would call me a gossock at the start, which just means, you know, generic outside white man. By the time you've generated some actual intimacy and you turn the camera on, you get much better intimacy than on camera. You get honesty, you get emotion, you get real stories. But that takes a long time. You won't do that. You simply won't do that on a 2-day trip to do a news report. You may not. I didn't get it until trip number 3, so I'm in week 5 and 6 of shooting. So again, it's very luxurious, but essential to feature documentary to have that long run in.
And have they seen the film, and what do they think of it?
So I flew to the village without cameras in December, just gone, and we projected the film on the wall of the gym. And on the first night, about half the village came to see it, and the response was massively positive. There's one character in the film called Stanley Tom, who is kind of not quite the villain of the piece, but he's the compromised person in the piece. He is the only person I heard express displeasure. And many people, the women in particular, came up to me afterwards and said, that's us, you know, we can recognise ourselves in that. And for me, that's the bar. When you make a film, when you make a documentary, you should be able to show it to the people who are in it and have them shake your hand at the end and go, that's okay. We see ourselves in that.
I'm just wondering how the good people of Malahide would feel if a documentary maker was to fly in from wherever, Alaska, perhaps.
Yeah.
Would you take part in it?
And talk about their Range Rovers.
They're Chelsea tractors. Well, how would you feel about it?
I'm
being serious.
If an Alaskan filmmaker came to Malahide...
Why wouldn't they be curious about you people and how you live?
They should absolutely do that. They should absolutely do that. I think that would be... massively important. In fact,
interesting for all of us to see.
Well, I've had two visitors from the village over since filming stopped late last year. So Jackie has been to Dublin.
Right. And how do they view the way you live? Because I know in the movie the walls are paper thin, they don't have running water, they're using the toilet bucket, the honey bucket, is that what you call it?
The honey bucket, yeah.
So, I mean, they don't have those kind of basic services that we have.
No, but again, they wouldn't be so alien to them because the village is that particular type of life. Harold describes it as a third world life. But they are only a short flight away from in Bethel. They do have running water and they have
toilets.
But
where they live, they don't.
No,
but what I mean is if they came here, it wouldn't be so exotic. Because again, they're American citizens. A lot of Bosco is in college, went to college in Fairbanks. So they're not so disconnected from the first world, but they don't get to live. They don't get to live in the first world in their village.
Well, certainly. Do they want to? Yeah.
Now, that's kind of the core question that both Harold is asking himself and Raman is asking himself during the seal hunt. You can go to a city, you can get a job, and you can earn money, you can live in a house, and you can have all of these benefits, but you lose that freedom. There's a tremendous amount of freedom, which is one of the reasons I kept going back. Like, the village is quite a poor place, but it's also a wonderful place. There's Raman. There was a day when we finished doing some work and Raman, we went back to his house and his mother said, there's nothing for the dinner. And so Raman picked up a rifle and we went and we walked a mile past the airstrip and we waited and we shot four geese. Now, I say we, he shot the geese. I didn't shoot the geese. But that took about an hour. We shot four geese. He brought them back to his mother. She stripped them, dressed them, and that was dinner for the night. It's not performative when they say that's important to them. They want to live. And so they realize that if you go to the city, that's what you lose. And most of them aren't willing to make that trade. Harold was, and to a certain extent he's a little bit miserable about that. Well, because he knows what he's given up.
It sounds fascinating. Where can we see it?
You can see it in Irish cinemas beginning the first week of October.
Great.
It's going to be on in Rathmines.
In Omniplex there or Stella?
In Omni, I believe.
Okay.
It's going to be in the Lighthouse, the IFI. We're having a screening at the Gate in Cork. And I want to say the one in Galway.
Yeah.
Hashtag Losing Alaska and also Breakout Pictures are doing the release. So there'll be information
all over.
It should be hard to avoid.
It will be very easy for our listeners because just go to our website and you should be able to find the details there, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Tom, thank you very much indeed. Now, how many times have you been out for a walk only to come across an animal in distress? A young bird that has fallen out of a nest? A hedgehog wandering around during the day? Or a seal pup stranded on a beach? What should you do? Ring the Gardaí, ring the local SPCA, or maybe ring a local wildlife rehabilitation organisation. There are many excellent wildlife rehab organisations throughout the country. Most are voluntary and run by a small number of dedicated people. Recently, a conference organised by Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland took place in Sonarta, which is an interactive visitor centre promoting ecological awareness and sustainable living based in County Meath. Rehabilitators were invited from all over the country to meet, share ideas and, more importantly, gain valuable knowledge and practical information from leading wildlife experts. A key focus of the conference was an exciting initiative to establish a national wildlife hospital, which is hoped will be in operation within a few short years.
It's going to be a wildlife rehabilitation and training hospital. So it's going to be like a central hub, basically, for rehabbers all over the country. That's going to be in the Fingal area.
And if you want to hear about this, you can just log on to the website or download our podcast. And that's rte.ie mooney.com/Mooney, because Terry Flanagan has made a special report for us there. So more Mooney Goes Wild when you finish listening to this programme now by simply visiting the website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Jarlath Holland, to Sheila O'Callaghan and Sheila Neveal on sound. We'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, visit the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Goodbye.